my good friend who has been my solicitor for a very, very long time. It must be, goodness, about 15 or 16 years he's been my solicitor, and I've followed him around from one organisation to another, and he's now been pretty stable for quite some time now with Munro Thompson and his mate Terry, who many of you have seen on the DVDs, and when we talk about legal issues and those types of things on everything from, divorce and wills and estate planning right through to contracts and doing, the legal side and rights and obligations when actually contracting on property both as a seller and as a buyer. So, Calvin, are you on the line?
I am.
Hey, Calvin, can you, I gather you can see my screen as well?
Yes, I can see your screen if that's you in the foreground of the sunset.
No, it's not me in the foreground. Okay, let's first of all start to have a talk about contracts. I mean, I have to put something on the screen. But before we get into that, can you give me a little bit of a background on you and what you do and, what you specialise in?
Sure. My background is Dipna has kindly shared before. I've been her lawyer for, quite a few number of years now, and the lack of hair is also showing. I've been a lawyer for, since 1990 or thereabouts. What I do now most is business advice, property, and generally, as a lawyer for a lot of small companies, landlords, and developers as well. I've been on the coast, on the Sunshine Coast, now for since '93, with a young family, twins, 5-year-olds, and generally enjoying and living and working on the Sunshine Coast.
Okay. So tonight we're going to be talking about contracts. Now, obviously, I've got a few examples here, and they are Queensland examples, but the contracts, by and large, the things that we'll be talking about on contracts, they're a little bit different in state to state, but they're not hugely different. And if you want to have a look at what the standard contracts are, if you've never had a look at the contracts in varying states, the thing to do would be to go to the Real Estate Institute in your particular state and download a copy of the state contract for that area. Have a good read of it. The Real Estate Institutes in each of the respective states have quite a deal of information that you can go through, and guidelines and, rights and obligations and things like that. And it's not just about where you live, it's more about where you're buying the property. That's actually what is, something that is more important than, that's a contract that you have to use for the state that you're actually buying the property in rather than where you live. So knowing the differences amongst the states is actually a very good idea. So Calvin, what I thought we might do is I will actually get rid of this, we didn't want that, get rid of the screen there, and I might bring up some of the one that you've got there. Now let's start with this one here. Now this is a PDF of a contract that you've sent through to me. And what are we looking at here? What is this front cover thing, and what does it actually mean?
This form, which is called a PAMD Form 30C, is a warning statement. It's meant as a warning to prospective buyers of real estate in Queensland and residential real estate in Queensland. This form doesn't form part of the contract in commercial property, only in residential property. It is meant, as it says, a warning to buyers that before signing a contract that it essentially involves a major decision for most people, and to be wary about what they're doing before they do so. Now, this form, as you can see, I'm just seeing whether I can manipulate it. It's in its umpteenth version now, and this one is version 5. So, you know, it's had several lives. And it's been changed a couple of times because of things that have occurred with this document. Essentially, it's come about as a consumer protection policy from the government for whatever reason. They feel that consumers need the protection. Now, part of, again, with these type of forms, in my mind, is, as you can see with the front page, look, it's clear enough. And then the second page is a bit wordy before you even get to the real contract. So, you know, it can sometimes jumble up things and people are not even looking at it. It's so much words that, you know, it loses its impact. Now, on top of all of this, in Queensland, right now as we speak, apart from this warning statement before you sign, an agent, because most times these types of contracts are run by agents, they have actually to give you a first direction notice. So they actually have to provide another piece of paper to direct your attention to this form. So this is how, look, in my mind, ridiculous this consumer protection has become. So before you even get to the guts of what you're meant to be doing, you have forms to say beware, and here's another form to say look at the beware form before you even start the contracting. Now, again, if I'm repeating myself, all of this I think sometimes confuses the whole process and just makes it even more unwieldy to deal with. Now, in other states, most of their contracts have warning statements. I think in the New South Wales one, I looked at it a few days ago. It's actually caught up in like the second or third page of the document. So, again, I don't know how relevant that may be if it's not on the front page. And this is where it says there is a cooling off period. And I think in most states in Australia, in the residential contracts arena, there is a cooling off period for buyers before they are bound. But generally with these sort of cooling off periods, there is a penalty for cancelling a contract in the cooling off period. In Queensland, it's 0.25% of the purchase price to be taken out of the deposit if you pay a deposit for the contract. So, sorry.
Go on.
Sorry. All I guess I was saying is the governments throughout Australia, I think, are trying to harmonize their laws, so trying to sort of bring them all in line. By and large, most of the times when you're dealing in property in Australia, there is, to some extent, some harmony with the laws. There are differences in the contracts, but generally, apart from New South Wales to an extent, because it stands apart with the exchange of contracts, the process and the terms and the cooling off periods and the warnings are generally all there for most consumers to deal with. Talking again, residential property only. If you're talking about the commercial field, no warning periods. I guess the assumption there is if you're buying commercial property, you're a savvy person. Right or wrong, I'm not sure.
Calvin, would you mind just speaking up a little bit? I'm getting a few messages coming through asking you to speak up a little bit when you're talking.
Yep.
Now, you've actually you've had a little bit of success, I guess, in getting people out of contracts that they don't want to be involved in.
Yep.
Because this whole front piece has not been signed properly, or the procedures haven't been followed. Where,
that's right,
particularly, you know, someone who's you know, it's, you know, they might have signed an off the plan deal, and then the market didn't go up like they thought it was going to, and then, you know, 2 years later they're buying something that might be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 over the market value today. And you know, I've personally have had a number of students bring, you know, in them send me emails about that sort of thing, that, you know, that's what's happened. Because, you know, they've signed up on that kind of stuff without doing due diligence, and, you know, normally before meeting me as well. So what does it really mean? What are you actually doing there, Calvin?
All right. Well, there
But you'll have to speak up, Calvin.
All right. You've touched on a couple of things there. Now, we're talking here mainly residential contracts and residential properties. This Form 30C is only one part of generally a contract document. When you're talking about long-term contracts and off-the-plan contracts, with off-the-plan contracts, there are even more disclosure documents, even more consumer protection type documents before you even get to the guts of the contract. Now, some of our, I guess, if you want to put it, successes in getting people out of contracts, now bearing in mind you're talking here as a buyer wanting to get out, if you are the seller, you're going to feel pretty, well, not so good about that whole process if someone has managed, you know, in their minds, weasel out of a deal when you sign up on a particular day, and then in 8 months' time they say, oh, sorry, changed my mind, thanks for coming, see you later. So, you know, the seller will always feel hard done by. But leaving that aside, in terms of these types of disclosure documents, it is pretty cutthroat at times. If you get it wrong, you give your buyer an automatic get-out-of-jail card. So in the instances where we have helped helped buyers, where I guess especially in the last couple of years, last, you know, 12 months or so, where they've, you know, signed up at day one, and then at, you know, the 12-month period, the property prices have come down, they're re-looking at their finances. The finances that were there maybe now not looking so good, may come to us and present a position to say, you know, is there a way that we can legally get out of this contract? The longer the contract, I guess, the more important to get those documents right at the very start, especially if you are the seller. Now, the ones we've gotten out, have relied to some extent this Form 30C, where at that relevant time, I guess a lot of agents weren't schooled enough to give those direction notices, and that provided an automatic out. The other issues with some of those long-term contracts, and they generally are off the plan ones, there are also other disclosure documents that need to attend to it. Now, again, some agents and even sometimes their solicitors don't get those documents right. Those things also give an automatic out for the buyers. The other parts that we, I guess, have had success is in some of these disclosure documents, there are certain representations as well that are made. Some of the representations may be, with this particular development, we will be putting in a pontoon, putting a pool, putting certain things. Now, these things generally add value to a lot that you are buying. Now, if there's some change to those things, and we had one I recall where in some of the advertising material and even some of the disclosures indicated that a pontoon was going to be built. It wasn't built, and we managed, I guess, convince the buyer's lawyers that to let us out would be better than not to let us out. So those are the type of things that we have had some success in I guess, letting buyers out of contract or convincing sellers that they've got their contracts wrong.
Hmm. Okay. So the importance of the warning obviously is a big part of that, and the whole procedure with which the contract has been presented and all of those sorts of things, which I mean really comes back to in all of this stuff, regardless of what state you're in,
yes.
Dealing with a property lawyer who
yes.
knows, I guess, well, loopholes is really the wrong word, but you know, who is acting on your behalf to either you know, cement a contract that somebody else might be trying to get out of, or on the other
yes.
side get out of a contract,
yes.
there may be things that can be done depending on procedural
yes.
issues and all that sort of thing, and I guess yes. each case is going to be totally individual, and you can you know, you need to be talking to your specialist property lawyer in that respect. We better get on to the contract, Calvin.
Yep.
Now, here's an example of the contract. Now, we'll just go a few things. Contract name. Well, I guess we start off there with date. Well, that's going to be the date, the agent, whatever. But the contract name that you put on there as, you know, as the buyer, there's a lot of talk around the different states about putting things in like a name and or nominee. I had a question email just before the before the webinar to say, you know, is there any way that you can cover yourself if you're going to put in a company as trustee for something, but you haven't formed the company or you haven't formed the trust yet? What do you do? Maybe we should answer those ones first.
Sure. Look, a company.
You're going to have to
I
speak
guess.
Up, Calvin. I'm still getting questions. Can you speak up?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry about that. A company is a separate legal entity. So if you put down and sign on behalf of someone that doesn't exist yet, if the company hasn't been formed, then technically there is no contract in existence. Now, I mean, we know that I guess people do sign these things up, and a company may be then formed the next day or the day after. And generally, you know, if everyone's happy and no one sort of looks beyond that and contracts settle, no one is the wiser. However, when you strike problems, then people start looking at everything, and then they start looking at, gee, this company was formed, you know, 2 days before it was signed, or 2 days after it was signed, sorry, then question marks come into, you know, has it been validly formed? Can it be validly formed? I think the answer to that is probably no. You know, if you don't exist at the time, you can't sign something at the time. You may come into existence you know, in 2 days' time, but at the time, you know, it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coming to the all nominee stuff, it's not illegal to put that in there. You know, you can do that, and what it means is, you know, I'll sign today as Calvin or my nominee, and when it comes to settle, I'll put someone else in there. And that's fine because it's clear. The main issue with that is a tax issue, and normally it is stamp duty, where the, you know, most state revenue officers take a view that it is a double transaction. It is two transfers. It's Calvin buying and then Calvin selling on to his nominee, so they will tax you twice. For the contract, so that is the issue. It's a tax issue with that one, a tax problem having an all nominee clause in there.
Now that's where the states vary a little bit,
yep.
isn't it? Because if you do it in Queensland and you want to and you sign the contract and or nominee. The only way you can really put a nominee in there in Queensland is if you you ask the seller prior to the contract going unconditional that they agree to cancel that contract put a new contract in place with another name and I guess all the other conditions the same. But, you know, if the seller's done a contract with you and the price has gone up in the meantime, or he realises that, you know, he could have got a better offer somewhere else, he doesn't have to say yes, does he?
No, and that is the risk of using that strategy. So always, I think, the way to sort of deal with that problem is to ensure that your selling entity is already fixed in your mind. And I guess this is where you tell your students the market-ready part of, you know, looking at these sort of deals, and part of the puzzle is getting your buying entity correct or set up so that when you're ready to sign, there's no question mark about, oh, I haven't talked to my accountant yet or whatever the case may be, and then hope for the best.
And I guess that's where, you know, like in Victoria, for instance, you've got the assigning abilities, and you're able then to assign the contract to your nominee effectively. So
yes,
it's a lot easier in Victoria than in others. You know,
that's right. I think the other jurisdictions are like Queensland, and you have the double duty issue to worry about. And also, I think in other states, it doesn't allow you to buy as trustee as well.
No.
Those are the sort of variations that you may have in different states.
Mm. Now, the main two states you need to be wary of for the trustee issue is if you're buying as a company as a trustee for a trust, New South Wales and Victoria, where only the legal entity, which is the company, is recognised, and that's all that goes on the contract for New South Wales.
Yes.
And that's all that goes onto the title deed in New South Wales. But for New South Wales but for Victoria, you can actually put the company as trustee for the trust, but that's not what appears on the title. Only the company name appears on the title. So you know, there's a little bit of a variance there. All the other states, as I understand, is you can either it goes directly as the company as trustee for the trust, or it will. You can actually have the trust nominated, if you like, and designated as being that company as trustee for that trust. It's a secondary procedure, but that's actually what it is. And obviously, Calvin, in New South Wales, we've got the issue of not being able to do conditional contracts, where in New South Wales we've got, you know, to sign a contract in New South Wales, basically you're still hanging yourself out to dry. Because the seller can still gazump you, they can still sell it to somebody else for a better price or whatever, until you actually go unconditional, which in New South Wales is called exchanging, where you exchange contracts. But there are a few outs there in that in New South Wales, unlike in some of the other states, particularly Queensland, you can contract to have an extended cooling off period.
Yes.
So that is a little bit of a protection. You can actually contract in your contract to protect, to extend your cooling off period. Now, that doesn't mean you get all of your deposit back, but it does mean that you get some of it, most of it back. You lose the 0.25, basically. So there's a little bit of a variance there. Now, Calvin, I've just got a couple of questions here that have come in. One of them was, is it actually illegal if you don't have a company company formed at the time of signing a contract, and you do put another name in there, and you then, you know, run off the next day or the day after and get it formed? Now, there's a little bit of a risk there because somebody else might have that company name and or that name that you can't have it, and then of course you've signed a contract in a name that will never exist. But is it, if assuming that you are able to register that other name as a company, is it illegal? Like, are you getting yourself into trouble? Is it something that anyone would action against you for?
So what you're saying is you put a name, you know, ABC Pty Ltd, but it's not formed. But when it's formed,
yes,
you sign it. Is it?
That's
is
right.
Is that the question?
Yes.
No problems with that. So once you know it's been formed, put your signature on straight away. But yes, as you say,
you've signed a contract for ABC Proprietary Limited, but at the time of signing it, ABC Proprietary didn't exist. It existed a day later or 2 days later.
Yes. I guess that was my point. If you don't exist, you can't sign the contract. Now, those things I know sometimes slip the net because who is really looking at that? You only look at that if someone is looking to get out of their obligations and may look behind, you know, your selling or buying entity, or normally the buying entity, and say, well, sorry, this contract doesn't exist because when you signed it, this thing didn't exist, so consequently, I'm selling it to someone else. So that is the risk, you know, and the risk, I guess, also on – sorry?
But is there a penalty?
The penalty, I guess, is this. They will say, you shouldn't have done that. I've incurred costs. Please pay me my costs. Or I had another contract or another person ready to buy. I lost that. I'm now going to sue you for that lost contract, potentially, maybe. Okay?
Yeah. So it would only be in the case of somebody losing as a result of that taking place, which would be unlikely. You could lose your contract if somebody wanted to get out of it.
Yes. Well, I mean, in a sense, you're misrepresenting yourself at the time of signing to suggest that this thing exists because that's what you're saying. This is the company I'm signing, and you're, in a sense, saying it exists because you wouldn't do it otherwise. So it's a misrepresentation of the fact.
Yeah. Somebody's actually written in here and said, I've signed a contract in Queensland recently, and I used the or nominee and got around getting the purchaser to reissue a contract by having a declaration signed by all those who were nominees. Do you know anything about that? Something I've never heard of.
Yeah, no, I mean, the only thing I can think of there is that the nominees were all the same people, or the beneficiaries of that particular trust were all the same people, so consequently there was no change in the actual beneficial interests of that transaction. For instance, if I have my name down and as trustee of my family trust, and I'm the only family member of that family trust, and I say at the end of the day I'm going to put that or nominee that trust, then maybe there is no change in ownership. It's one and the same. So that's the only argument that I can think of there. But no, it's,
it is something to be very careful of anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that's what those sort of things highlight is, you know, when you put that all nominee stuff, you got to be very sure of it. And it may be in that instance they didn't have a way out of it and tried to get around it. And in that instance, maybe it was successful.
Yeah. Okay, well, we better move on here. That's all the parties. Now, obviously, as you can see there, when using structures, they've got to be the, the ABNs and full addresses and all of that sort of thing involved there. Let's, the property description. Oh, hang on a minute. I'll just flick past that. Just wait a minute. Excuse me. Let me just go back up here on the first page. The property description and the, the present use, all of that sort of thing. Have you got anything to say there about the inclusions of fixtures, fittings and chattels and present use of the property? How important is all that?
Oh, look, I guess every detail in these contracts are important because especially when you put down the title references and stuff, I mean, of course, if you put the wrong reference numbers in, then are you selling the right thing or, transferring the right things? So obviously you've got to be careful, and how you get it, make sure about that is do a current title search. And, well, I say generally agents should be doing it, but sometimes I know they don't do it and just rely on maybe like a rate search or something and just plug in numbers in there. Now, where it shows up really is I think if you look at matters affecting property, title encumbrances. Now, if you leave that part blank, you are saying to the buyer there are no encumbrances on the title. Now, what happens is sometimes there are easements on the title. Now, if you don't list those things down, the buyer has a right at settlement to say to you, get rid of that easement. And generally, you won't be able to do so, which then also comes back to you have given your buyer an out. So All of these stuff is important. Now, the included and excluded chattels, you've got to fill them in to the extent that included chattels, I mean, if you're the buyer, you're going to be more interested in that to make sure, oh, look, pool equipment all comes in, correct? Yes. If you're the seller and you want to make sure certain things are excluded, I'm keeping the creepy crawly, or the dishwasher. So this is where you've got to be sure, as buyer or seller, which is included or excluded. So, yes, those things are all very important.
Just a couple of things there. I was just reading those questions, which kind of backtrack a little bit.
Yep.
It says in WA you will show the trustee name only. That is correct, but you can actually apply to the Office of State Revenue over there to have the trustee listed on the title deed. It's not, they're not the legal entity by any means, but you can actually have it designated, I think it's called. The other thing here is, and I'll read this one here to you, Calvin. I know I'm backtracking, but I'm trying to clear these questions as I go. I saw a contract where an and or nominee clause was signed and the CFO signed the property on behalf of the company. There was a clause showing the CFO had essentially gone guarantor on the purchase. Is this normal? Actually, yeah, I have seen these. Whenever you're using a structure, often the person who is selling the property insists on an individual guaranteeing behind the structure where it's a trust and that sort of thing, particularly in the southern states. Have you come across that, Calvin?
All the time. Now, just bear in mind when you're dealing with a Queensland property, and I think it's probably across the board too, in these sort of residential contracts, there is generally no guarantor clauses in to capture buying entities directors. Now, if you are selling to a company structure, as a seller, I think it is a good idea to make sure the people behind the company are caught up in this contract because, you know, why a company, I mean, you've done all the DIPNIS, you know, asset protection stuff. You're generally dealing with a $2 company. If they decide to renege on the deal and say, well, sue me. And if there's nothing to be gotten at, what is the point? So you want the individuals behind all this stuff. And generally with these sort of land contracts, especially when you're selling to investors and you're selling to structures, make sure that there's a director's guarantee document caught up in it as well, so it will form like a secondary part of the contract. Just dealing with this guarantee part as well. In the commercial contracts, there are guarantee clauses built into those contracts. So, you know, this is the difference between dealing residential stuff and commercial stuff. But it's very common to expect that coming from sellers or their lawyers.
Yeah. Because there's so much activity now in structures, they're wanting a little bit more than a shell that doesn't have any assets if they need to sue it, basically, if you don't honour the contract, yeah?
Absolutely, and I guess also it depends, you know, on the property and how hard people want to sell it and how much you value your guarantees. You know, if it's not a given that the guarantees will be given, you know, so it's negotiable.
That's right. The other question was, we've obviously been talking about companies, and the companies need to be in existence before you sign the contract. There's a question here which is a little bit cheeky. It says, if I've got a company in existence, do I need a trust to be in existence when I sign the contract? Well, you and I both know there is ways around that, but what's your answer going to be, Calvin?
My answer is the only answer, which is yes. yes.
Okay. While Calvin says yes, which is absolutely correct, and that is the final answer, let me just tell you a little bit about registering trusts and things like that. You've got at least a month in most states to be able to register the existence of trusts, and of course, you know, there may be able to be a little bit of variance in the signing date and the start date. But if it really came down to it, and if it really, you know, there was a problem and it went to court and everything else, and the full subpoena was sent out there for when the trust was in existence and whatever, it would be able to be determined that the order for the trust did not go in until after the signing of the trust. Until after the signing of the contract, I beg your pardon, and in which case you wouldn't have a leg to stand on. So Calvin's answer is absolutely correct. Did that cover that well enough, Calvin?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And again, with all these things, people are only going to take that hard forensic line and look at the, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Generally, when there's a lot of money involved and when people are upset about something. You know?
That's right. Now, the issue here is there's a little bit of a question here about solicitors. You need a solicitor in the state in which you are buying the property. And, Calvin, you're able to help out with that if they're looking for solicitors and things like that, because even though you're in Queensland, and obviously you can do everything in Queensland, you have a referral network all around Australia that people can hook into, and you can refer who to deal with in other areas that are part of your wider group, if you like. Is that right?
Yep, correct.
And how do they do that?
I guess in the first instance, give us a call. We're more than happy to talk to anyone, or you just send us an email to say, could you refer us to, you know, a lawyer in whatever state you're in. I guess the only one that we don't sort of have any representation in is in Tasmania and the Northern Territory. But all the other states, we've got it covered.
Okay. So to get hold of you, it would be Calvin, C-A-L-V-I-N, at Munro Thompson.
Yep. .com.
.com, no AU?
.com.au, sorry, yep.
.au, okay, .com.au. I'll put that one there up at the end of the call as well. Calvin, let's move on. Let's. We've talked about the description and how important that is with the, with what's included and not included. Something I've found to be particularly contentious with buying properties at the upper end of the market at the moment is built-in coffee machines, because a lot of them have them these days, and built-in steam ovens and that sort of thing that are in a tall. Tall cabinet, and you know, it's a bit of a contentious issue as to whether they are plumbed in or not plumbed in and whether they're included. So if you expect them to be there on settlement day, then I suggest you include them in the contract directly.
Yeah, wine fridges is another one.
Fridges, did you say?
Issues. Sorry?
Wired or wide?
Wine.
A wine fridges, okay.
Yes, the built-in ones.
Yeah. Okay, matters affecting the property. What have you got to say about that bit?
I think I covered that with in terms of the title encumbrances, to make sure that if you're the seller, that all your encumbrances are noted down in there. And if it isn't...
Including easements and things.
Including easements, especially easements. The tenancies is another one that you have to include, because if you're selling your investment property and there's a tenant in there and you're selling to someone that is buying it for their home and you leave that blank, you're saying there is no tenant in there. Come settlement time, there will be an expectation that the tenant is out. And you will give your buyer an out if you haven't filled in these blanks correctly.
Okay.
So, yeah, it, all of this stuff, you know, whilst it looks innocuous in itself, it can be very, very important down the line, especially when you're asking someone to give you money at the end of the day.
Okay, I've got a question here. What other types of encumbrances could there be other than easements?
I'm just trying to think through that. Generally, it is the easements that are there. There may be... I can't think of any that would look, there could be sometimes caveats on it that need to be removed. There could be writs on it as well. So there are a couple of things that could be on it.
Okay. We better keep moving, Calvin, because we haven't even talked about options yet.
No.
Okay, the price, obviously, you know, that's pretty self-explanatory with the deposit and whatever else. Finance. I want to talk about this pest building and finance clauses.
Yep.
What should be there? Because basically you've got to cover yourself off so that they are, you know, that you have the most flexibility to get out of it, if you like. And
absolutely.
That finance and those types of things, I guess, are to buyer's satisfaction.
Well, if I can get to that, one of the main things is, you know, these contracts in Queensland are built in so that you can have or activate these clauses. Now, the important thing firstly is if you need it, that you make sure that these clauses are in fact activated. Now, on your screens, you will see on the side margin on the right-hand side, and it says in the finance, unless all of those three things, finance amount, finance year, finance date, are completed, this contract is not subject to finance. Now, I've seen contracts where, you know, you may put the finance amount, but you leave the finance year's details out, but you put the finance date. Look at that side margin note. Not all completed, not subject to finance. There's the argument for the seller to say, sorry, this contract's not subject to finance. Equally
wow.
with the building and pest as well. See those things there? All of these words have got some meaning to them. They're there for a purpose. Most people do not read them because there's so many words on the page. No one, unless you deal with these sort of things all the time, get the grip of all of this stuff. It's in your face, and most people don't even read that stuff because they only focus on that finance stuff. Oh, yeah, finance here, yeah, whoever, I don't need to fill that in. Building inspector, yeah, I don't know who it is yet. So you've got to make sure.
So what do you put in, Calvin?
All right. What do you put in? When you don't know, you put in their buyer's choice, okay?
Okay.
Finance amount. If you don't know, or maybe you don't want to disclose what you're actually borrowing, you just put words to something to the effect of sufficient to complete the contract. Okay? Financier, if you don't know yet, you're still shopping around, you are going to put something like a bank or a similar financial institution. Okay? Finance date, make sure it's clear. If you've got a date in mind, you stick that date in, or if it is referable to something or can be calculated with certainty, for instance, 14 days from the date of this contract. So there is a certainty to that. So once you fill all those things in, the clauses are activated, and it is in the finance, it is clause 3, and I think I've given you all the fine print stuff as well, and clause 4 deals with the building and pest. Now, Dipna also mentioned to your satisfaction stuff, you know, so that, hey, if someone offers you finance at, you know, loan shark rates, have you got finance? You probably do, but you probably don't want to accept that. Now, I don't know whether, Dipna, you can scroll down to... Page 5. And this is part of the fine print stuff. And I'm just trying to get you all to look at the pages and the clauses. Next page.
You want the next one?
Yep, next one. Yep.
That's finance, building.
Yep. All right. If you all can
settlement.
See those. Yep. If you look at clause 3.1, if you fill in all the all the blanks. This contract is conditional on the buyer obtaining approval, blah, 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 on terms satisfactory to the buyer. So it's built in there for you guys. You don't have to worry about it. You fill those three blanks, it's in there. And you, the only thing you have to do as a buyer, you have to take reasonable steps to obtain approval, okay? Now, if you look at the building and pest one, I don't know if you can show that a bit more, Dipna.
There we go.
In clause 4.2, it says you have to, oops.
4.2?
Terminate 4.2. See there, 4.2, you may terminate, etc., if the report is unsatisfactory to the buyer. Now, the only thing that sort of qualifies it is you must act reasonably with that one. So, you know, if you don't like the color of the walls, I'd suggest that's probably unreasonable. But it's all there, so you don't have to touch it after that.
So we've talked about, we haven't talked about it, but we have at the seminars and things. We've talked about due diligence clauses.
Yep.
Where would they go? They would come up here under the special conditions?
Yeah, and there's quite
blank
a bit of
space here.
Yeah, and that's where you generally fill in. And sometimes, you know, the contract is so conditional that that space is not sufficient. So you just sort of do an extra page in there, and then you just fill the special conditions to your heart's content.
Now, just while we're on due diligence clauses, I don't think I've got one here tonight, but what I do have is Calvin and Terry have been very kind to give us an example of a due diligence clause that is in your home study course. It's in the blue, skinny, spiral-bound booklet. There's a lot of clauses in there, and one of them is a due diligence clause. So we won't go through that tonight because it is there for you. But, I mean, just before we finish on contracts, the electrical and safety switches, alarms, anything to say really about that?
Look, not really. Nothing really sort of hinges on that insofar as, you know, termination rights are concerned. It's just sort of been put in there to capture all that sort of stuff in there. Nothing really turns on it, but, you know, no one's terminated because you haven't filled that in properly.
Mm. Okay, the special conditions, basically, that's where you put in everything else that, I mean, due diligence covers you for a multitude of sins, and your clauses obviously get you out if, you know, if it's not to your satisfaction, pretty much anything. Other things that you may have in there, you know, that's where you start to put in conditional upon, you know, obtaining a DA or the ability to be able to have access prior to settlement or any of the other things that you want would be specifically worded and put in those those special condition page of the contract on the next page there.
Correct.
All right. Calvin, I've lost you completely. I don't know what happened there.
Sorry, you got me?
Yes, I've got you back now.
Right, sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened.
Yeah, so we're just talking about the special conditions and putting everything else that you require in there. Now, I must say at this point, regardless of whether it's an options contract or whether it be a standard contract, and I don't believe you should be happily signing these contracts without the understanding of them, having been through it a number of times and having sat down with your solicitor and know exactly what you need to have, particularly when there's anything out of the ordinary with the contract. You know, as I said before, all the states have the real estate institutes in the respective states. You can download a copy of the standard REI, QV, NSW, whatever it might be, and you can go through that and have a read and know what the standard contracts cover. But in every case, I really would prefer you, if you went through your solicitor in the state where you're buying the property, to make sure that you've covered off on all those little things that, you know, if you've never done it before particularly, that you're not going, you know, you could have a problem with. Now, Calvin, let's actually have a little talk. I'll whiz through these questions first of all. What's an easement?
An easement is a right to use, or a permission to use your land for someone. For instance, if a block behind you is landlocked and they need an access using part of your land, there may be an access easement over your land which burdens your land to the benefit of your neighbor, allowing them access into their land. So that easement is will appear on your title, and it encumbers your land. So you, when you sell that property, that easement goes with it because it's for the benefit of your neighbor. The more common, well, that's common. The other ones that you will find a lot of are council easements. So council may have a drainage easement or some easement of that sort of services nature so that they can have access to it to fix up pipes, etc.
Okay, we'll get rid, I'll delete that one there. With respect to inclusions, is it okay to have a video at the time of looking at the property where the seller states that, you know, what is and isn't included? How do you feel about that?
Look, having that sort of recording or imaging of the property is a good idea. However, if you just do it and not say anything, then I don't know what the value is. You still have to put in something to say the inclusions as, recorded in this video record viewed by the parties, dated whatever date, so that there's still some reference in the contract that catches up on that stuff. Otherwise, it is, you know, just prepare the list of whatever it is. Now, if you've got to have a video record because it's such a big list, then you've got to make sure that, you know, both parties have agreed that that is a proper record and that it is caught up somewhere in writing in the contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the next question here is, I found a solicitor who enforced part of the contract, which meant that the client needed to actually receive a decline letter for finance. Is it often the contract not initialized against this section? I quite understand the last bit there, but basically, you know, if you want to get out on finance clause, is it the seller's right to demand a copy of a decline letter from a financial institution?
Look, the going back to that clause, the qualification on you not getting a finance to your satisfaction is that you have taken steps to obtain approval. So normally how people show that they have gone to that effort is that they have a letter from their bank to say they've been declined their finance to show that they've at least made a step towards getting approval. So it's no point going and saying, you know, at the finance date, I haven't got approval, where you have not even tried to get finance. Okay, so
it is in the seller's right to ask for it?
Sorry?
It is in the seller's right to ask for it?
Well, sorry, that's what I was getting at. Can they insist on it? Well, to the extent that you have to show something that you have acted reasonably in terms of getting approval. Now, how is this relevant, or, you know, how would this all occur? This, I guess the pressure points with all of this is, generally you will have some level of deposit locked in. When you terminate a contract, you'll say, you know, I hereby terminate, but then the next step will be, please authorize the return of the deposit held by the agent. Now, if they feel that you've just been yanking their chain or whatever the case may be, they may not give that approval letter to the agent, and then your deposit is locked up. So you may feel that you would want to do that just to get your deposit back. Now, unless you don't care, maybe it's a $50, $100 deposit, and you go, well, you know, if you want to have a crack at me, have a go. But generally, that would be the sort of the pressures in terms of, do you produce some evidence or don't you?
Which is why when you sign your contract, something I prefer to do is put down a minimal deposit, like, you know, $100 or $1,000 or something like that, with the balance of the deposit being a substantial deposit, meaning 5% or 10% or whatever it is, upon finance approval.
Yep.
And you can actually put that in with your deposit, that it's a certain amount now and a certain amount upon finance approval. So that way you haven't actually locked in very much money if there's ever a fight to try and get that deposit back, and that gets around that sort of thing.
And certainly these contracts in Queensland sort of contemplates part payment of deposits. I don't know whether you can get back to that page, but where the price is, it also has deposit. You know, it's got blank dollars, initial deposit payable when buyer signs, and then balance deposit payable on. So, you know, it's there for you to use. So, yes, Dipna, I think that's a great idea, a smaller one to start off with that, in a sense, maybe you can afford to lose, and then the real hurt money comes in after that, after you've gone unconditional.
Okay. Is it normal to get an inspection report the day of inspection? No, it's not. They don't prepare them that quickly, so you've got to allow time for that to actually, to get the inspection report through. If you want vacant possession, you've got to put it in there that you I guess that goes in your special conditions, that you're requesting vacant possession. Is that right, Calvin?
Well, no, vacant possession is assumed, okay, when you buy this contract. And that's why, you know, I touched on that tenancy stuff. If you leave it blank and there is a tenant, you're meant to give them vacant possession. So if you're selling it with a tenant, make sure the tenant's details are filled in those blanks. But otherwise, you can assume vacant possession, because once you buy it and I pay you the money, I expect no one in the house.
Okay. There's a couple of questions here about referring to people. Send me through an email on that, and I'll, you know, referring a building inspector and all that sort of thing. I'll tell you who you can ask for that sort of thing. I won't do it here. What's the difference between a conveyancer and a property lawyer, Calvin?
Right. Look, I was actually going to touch on that previously, when you were talking about getting lawyers involved and all that sort of stuff, and if you're buying property, etc., a lot of this, or a part of this, buying the property is process driven, right? It's, you know, just dealing with doing searches, organizing your finance, dealing with your financier, organizing settlements, etc. So it's process-driven. The parts where I guess you would want a lawyer to look at is, and I think this is a good thing for, I guess, your students to consider as well, especially if they're starting up on this, is to consider the first few uses of your lawyer or your accountant or whoever it is as a learning process. Because what I've found dealing with some of your students, Dipna, is when they are, I guess, very green with this process, and I say that, I hope, in not an offensive manner, that, you know, we have to spend a bit more time to explain to them what they're actually trying to do, or trying to also flesh out what they're trying to do. So it takes a bit more time. It takes a bit more, I guess, skill and value adding to that process part of it. And then as you'll get and understand the process a bit more, it's a lot quicker. You know, it's just a phone call, I've got this deal, have a quick look at this, bang, you know, 15 minutes, we're done. So, you know, conveyancer may be okay for you if you've done a lot of this and you know exactly what you're doing and all you want someone to do is just drive a process through. But if you need advice on it, that's where a lawyer comes in to advise you on it. Your conveyancer,
and if something goes wrong.
Absolutely. Your conveyancer will not tell you all this stuff. Your conveyancer wouldn't have pointed out those marginal notes I would have pointed out you to, because they don't care. They're just there to run a process.
Okay. Last question before we get on to option agreements. And this is about accessing deposits. It says, if you are the vendor and the contract has been signed and agreed, all is straightforward, but the vendor needs some cash. Can they access the deposit funds early?
If you're happy to give it to them, absolutely.
Yeah.
It can be
released.
It
has to be in the contract, basically, that the buyer would have to agree that the vendor can access the funds immediately. Otherwise, it would be a no-go.
Yeah, look, but generally, if you're acting for a buyer, you'd be very cautious about saying to your client, you know, why would you want to do that, really?
Yeah. Mm. Okay, let's get on to option agreements. Let's talk about options generally. What are they used for? And just describe what's the difference between a put option and a call option.
All right. What are option agreements? I think, you know, if some of your students were in attendance in Melbourne over the weekend, I think Terry would have touched on some of this sort of stuff with the option agreements.
That's only some, so we need to go over it now.
Yep, no problems. Now, option agreements are, in essence, an agreement where you buy a right to do something in the future. So, for instance, you buy an option to purchase a property so that in the future, in a future date where you take up that option, you have a right to buy that property, and that's a call option. So you, the buyer, will take up an option, which is buying a right to buy a property, but not the obligation to do it. So you don't have to buy it, but you have the right to do so if you choose to do so, and generally in the future. And why do you have it in the future? For a variety of reasons. You could use that time to do all sorts of things, and it's really, in a sense, buying time and buying a look at the property, buying a look at the property for a particular purpose. Now, where are they used a lot? A lot of developers and property developers buy up all these options so that, again, they buy the right to buy it, but not the obligation. And that sort of, I guess that is a very important concept to grasp, because it allows you to pay a lesser amount to do something with property that is real, including adding value, which of course then minimizes your risk if you don't actually have to buy it at the end of the day. Again, that's
as you said, Calvin. This is option agreements are very common in the commercial and developing world.
Yep.
And they're not as common to buy a property off mum and dad, except in New South Wales where they're a little bit more commonplace and they're a little bit more accepted because they don't have the security of contract with a normal contract. So even the mum and dad that are selling their property are a little bit more au fait with an option agreement than perhaps, you know, others might be. But generally speaking, they are used to put your foot on a deal, to put your foot on a piece of land while you do something else. So while you apply for a material change of use, an MCU, or while you apply for the development application for a commercial building or a block of units, or, you know, get the building approval and the development approval through, and, you know, while you get all of that paperwork and council approvals and all of that sort of thing done, or, in fact, just even do due diligence. I mean, there can be just be for that as well. So, you know, your option agreement is, like a contract, it needs to have all of the clauses in it that cover you for everything that you want to do for a particular purpose or a particular purchase. Calvin, when you have an option agreement, I'll go through this one here that we've got here as an example. The option agreement normally has the contract attached to it, yeah?
Correct.
Just explain that process then.
All right. As we've said before, if you sign up an option agreement, you get the right to sign up a contract in the future. So when you exercise that option, so when you say, yes, I will buy it now, How you exercise that option is generally by signing the contract. And the contract is generally at the back, so everyone's clear at day one what is the form of the contract that will take. So all the details of the purchase will be caught up in there, you know, with the purchase price, etc., will generally be caught up in there. But maybe not the buying entity, because most option contracts, or a lot of option contracts, have, again, this may sound double Dutch to you, but may have nominee clauses in there. And you can certainly use the nominee clauses in the option contracts.
So the great thing about an option too is, I mean, if you sign up a property for on an option, and I've got a question here, you know, why would a seller sell, you know, give you an option? Well, in a lot of cases, you know, you're optioning up a farm, or you're optioning up a commercial piece of land or something like that, which, you know, the current owners can still go on and do what they normally do with that particular property on it anyway. And it's normally a more astute, well, I can't say it's normally more astute seller, but sometimes they are. So they, that's why they would be wanting to sell it to you that way. They're getting an option fee up front, which we'll talk about as to whether it should be an option or a license or that sort of thing in a minute. But on top of that, they normally get a bit of a higher price than they perhaps would otherwise if it was just a straight out, yes, I'm going to buy it today. So there's normally an uplift there in the price as well. So you've got your contract attached to your option agreement. Maybe, Calvin, we might just go through this agreement now and talk about that process, yeah?
Yes.
Now, the option fee that is paid, how much is it normally, and does the seller get it immediately?
Yeah. The option fee is the fee to get the right for the option, as it suggests. Now, how much should that be? Look, it varies. You know, I've seen it from, you know, a nominal fee, $2, $1, $10, to a real fee of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars at times. And can they access that? Again, also depends on the deal. Sometimes it may, the whole part of it can, or sometimes maybe a stage thing. So yes, I'll give you 10 grand during the due diligence period of the option agreement, and then a further amount maybe later on. It just depends. So there's no right or wrong or what is the fee. But the only, I guess, thing to be concerned here about that fee is that if it's a substantial fee, or even if it's not a substantial fee, is that it should form part of the purchase price, so that it is not on top of the purchase price. So it gets deducted off the purchase price of the contract. And if that is the case too, then I guess you also, you know, a couple of things, you know, crop up here, and it also is tax issues again. The call option fee could be, depending on who you are or your entity, subject to GST, okay? So the timing of that becomes an issue maybe. It could be subject to capital gains tax as well, okay? And it will definitely be subject to stamp duty. So all these things drive what is the price meant to be, okay?
So how else could we get out of the stamp duty issue, perhaps?
You can't get out of that stamp duty issue unless you want to make it a very nominal fee. You pay it, it's subject
when
to stamp duty.
When would you use a license then?
A license to come
a license
to your
fee property, as opposed to an option fee.
Well, you know, a license fee suggests to me that you then give someone a license to come into your property to do something to the property for some time, or use the property for a period of time, and that would be just a license fee. Is that what you're getting at, Dipna?
What I'm getting at is if we had the option and you've got the option fee there, and then you say the option fee is a minimal amount of money, but then behind that you have a license fee, which would be obviously released to the vendor as well. If we were paying a license fee as the bigger percentage of the money, would that mean that you wouldn't pay stamp duty on the license fee?
Yeah, I think you would have to be very careful in terms of how you draft that to make sure that it is an actual license fee and not an option fee. And this, again, is a tax question. In most states you have to self-assess, or your lawyers will have to assess the duty. But what happens also is the Office of State Revenue conducts audits on these on files, and if they look at a document, they may wish to assess it in their own way, and then there is an argument. Then what is a license fee? What is an option fee? Because for instance, in Queensland, what the Duties Act says that if you have a license fee, it is for a creation of a new right, so it never existed before, you just granted it. They will then look at the value of that license, so then it also still becomes a dutiable transaction as well. So it can be a very tricky question, Dipna.
Yeah.
On how you deal with this.
Okay, so we'll go through the document that we've got here. Obviously, the parties involved, the grantee, I guess, and the seller.
Yep.
There's nothing really there.
No.
Do you want to guide me through this, and I'll whiz up and down as you talk.
All right. Again, the grantee if you're the buyer, you're the grantee, so you get that option. Okay. Now, this document that I guess we've prepared in a sense for discussion purposes is one that has been used where the grantee buyer was using it to develop the property, so to get a development application for this for any property. So it could be a development of a retail 10 shops, or it could be anything. So, a 10-lot subdivision, whatever you want it to be. What this document allows is what we've discussed. You have the call option fee, a call option expiry date. So, there is a time frame for when this thing is meant to expire. And again, those dates are all negotiable depending on what you're looking for. In this particular document, I won't get you to flick up and down, Dipna, because it may be a little bit too difficult, but where I get to a point where I want you to focus on, I'll let you know. In this
instance, at the moment, I'm patient. I might just scroll down slowly while you're talking then.
Yeah. We have all the, relevant details at the end as a reference schedule, and it deals with, all the, seller, grantee, property. In this one, we have a due diligence date, so I can talk a bit of that. I know Dipna mentioned before about due diligence clauses. We've put one in here as well. And then the call option fee and the call option expiry date. In this example, we've got it as an 18-month document, okay? So you can see these things can last or could last years in some instances where some developments or some development applications take a lot of time. Now, just then sort of going through the document, we've started, with some definitional clauses or some definitions of terms that are used throughout the document. Then when you sort of get to the guts of it, we've got a due diligence clause in there. And the due diligence clause provides a time for the buyer to, in a sense, run through whatever they want to run through to make sure that if they're going to do or spend money on a development application, that it is going to be worth their while. Now, in this due diligence, you could be also looking at your financiers, all sorts of issues that you can look at for a particular time. If after this due diligence period, you're not happy with whatever it is, you don't go any further, terminate this whole option agreement, which then if we think back what we were talking about in terms of when do you put money down, when do you not put money down, we've structured this one so that, again, it gives you the option to say, look, you know, we'll put a little bit down on signing of this agreement and then a bigger amount after the due diligence has been satisfied, okay? So it also then gives everyone a lot more comfort because after you've satisfied your due diligence, you are then now going to start proceeding with your development application or whatever the case may be. Now, we've structured this one, probably in favor of the buyer because it allows quite a few things. One of them, especially with a development application, and this is where I guess you need to make sure that your lawyer or whoever you are using understands the full process of development applications and that whole process of developing a block of land in terms of council requirements to make sure all things are considered and captured. For instance, if you look at clause 3.4, which is I think where DIPNA is at the moment, or in this clause 3, we deal with the rights of the grantee to appeal any decision if they are not satisfied with that development application, so that you actually do have that time frame to do these things within the time scale that is generally sort of accepted with these processes. And, you know, DIPNA probably can tell you more than I can how long and tortuous some of these dealings with councils can be. In fact, I think you almost have to accept that it is the norm that it will be difficult. I do not know of any client that has gone through a DA and said, gee, that was easy. I have never heard of anyone saying that. So I guess you can take it from that the norm is it is a difficult thing to get through because council has their, Bible they will look at, and they're generally quite immovable about their positions, and you have dollars to worry about. They want generally a lot of stuff from you before you can to, you know, as part of the headworks to increase the infrastructure at your cost for the community. So there's a balancing act there as well that they have to deal through. So, but coming back through to this document with this development application, this option agreement allows you the time and ability, and you are now using someone's land to apply for a development application for that land. So, you know, you've been granted, to me, you know, incredible rights over someone's property. So this is, I guess, the power of these sort of documents, and you still are not obliged to buy this block of land. And that, I guess, is the beauty of these things for developers because, look, you will be spending a lot of money on this process, but it will be still less than purchasing the block of land. You will still be spending a lot of money on advisors, professional service providers, fees. And the question that DIPNA had before was, you know, why would a seller want to sell this? Because, you know, you may get an uplift straight away, but you also know these people will be serious about the process because they will be spending a lot of money on it. So, you know, you know you will have a motivated buyer, and if they can line their ducks in a row, everyone's going to be happy. So, you know, that's why sellers may consider this, and also they don't want to take the risk of development. They will take their uplift now and say, thank you very much. I leave something in the deal for you. Good luck. So that's that part of it. Now, going through the document, after we've dealt with granting the rights to develop or apply for this development application, you know, we deal with the more prosaic matters of the actual grant of the option, which is for the option fee paid, I grant you the option to buy this property at a particular time frame, up to a particular time frame. Some option agreements also just leave you a window to exercise the option. So it may be between certain dates that you have to exercise the option to purchase the property. Then we have a nominee clause so that, you know, if you've worked up your development application, you've added value to this property now. Now, you may at that point also wish to cash out on the deal. Now, you know, having a nominee clause, in a sense, then allows you to sell what you've sort of just done. So, you know, we put that in there to give, I guess, more flexibility in planning for developers, because we find that, you know, who knows what's going to happen in tomorrow, let alone in 18 months or 2 years' time. The whole environment may have changed, and, you know, you may want to cash out early at that time. And then, you know, the document then also then deals with, all right, I'm happy with everything. My ducks are all lined up. I want to now buy this property. How do you do that? The document then deals with, all right, generally, you know, you have to sign the contract, which is attached to the back of this document. Sign it. There's, you know, countersigning, and you're on. It's ready to go. Yeah, that's essentially this document in a nutshell. The other parts of it deal with the flexibility and also just the legal parts, just to tie it all together into a proper document. What we've also put in here is a power of attorney clause. And it empowers, or the seller appoints you, the buyer, assuming I'm talking to buyers, to sign on the seller's behalf, so that when, let's say, you have exercised the option, you've signed the contract says, all right, I deliver to the seller, seller has to then countersign, and then away we go. Let's say the seller then has cold feet and says, I don't want to sign this, or, you know, whatever happens at that point. We've got something here that says the seller has empowered the grantee to sign these documents, and you can then exercise that right and sign on their behalf and enforce this contract. So that is, again, something I guess we've put in there to empower buyers, so that everyone is kept honest on this deal, because in day one when this thing is signed, these were the intentions, that if I exercise this option, you will countersign the document to ensure that the contract then proceeds to settlement. If at that time you are feeling a bit shy about it, well, sorry, I will now call in this power of attorney and I will sign on your behalf, and we will just sell this land. At that point, whether you like it or not. Then we have the ability to caveat, so that if something also happens in terms of the seller encumbering their land or wanting to deal with it in any particular way, you can stop all these dealings by lodging caveats, etc. Again, I've sort of very conscious of time here. Given a fairly broad brushstroke of, you know, the mechanics of this document, but the essence of this document, to me, I think it is still, quite an incredible thing, and it's been utilized for a very long time in terms of enabling and empowering buyers and sellers to get together to deal with land where there is, I guess, some shift in the risk equation here, where you still are dealing like an owner of a land without the ownership risk. You are applying for a development application, which generally is only done by the owner of the land, and the document also will allow that the seller has to sign all these documents to enable the development application to be put through. So you get the use of that land for that purpose, but you don't wear the risk. Yes, you've worn some risk by paying an option fee, whatever that market fee will be, but you don't have to buy the land until you've lined up all your ducks. So I hope that gives you an overall picture of, you know, how this thing could work in theory, because it works in practice, and people use these techniques to secure, lock up, and value add property before having to, you know, dish out big dollars for these blocks of land. No,
Go on, you finish.
Sorry, I was just saying, I hope that gives you or your the listeners you know, hopefully a good understanding or a basic understanding of these documents.
I think you've done a great job there, Calvin. I think even just going through this document, I've been slowly scrolling through it. Something I really, really want to emphasize here is, because there's a number of people out there who are saying, oh, you know, this is how you do an option, this is why you do an option, and it's basically to secure the land, as we've talked about. They'll say, oh, go and use my document, you know, my document's good. But it's like, I would never do that in a pink fit. There's no way that I think anybody should go and use a standard document to go and put an option on something with the hope of, you know, on selling it to somebody else or to exercising the option. I mean, the contract's got to be with the option for starters.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're signing a pretty big document. As you can see, it's not a little document. And I am totally opposed to the concept of anyone using a standard document to run off and do this. It should be individually written by a solicitor in the state in which that you're doing doing the transaction, and these transactions can be done right across the country, who understands property law. I mean, and not every solicitor will specialise in property law. They just won't. I really, really want to emphasise that, because I know there's a lot of people out there that are putting their hopes and dreams on doing options and on selling them, which, you know, that's great. The concepts is good, and I will be dealing more with the, you know, the property side of the process in calls to come. And I'm happy to actually do that on the next call, particularly now that we've done this. If any of you've got questions about options or any of the other issues around them, I'll be back to talk to you on the next Q&A call in 2 weeks' time. If you want to, you know, discuss any of those, the legal side I really wanted to go through with Calvin, because, you know, Calvin's someone who, and the whole firm is someone who really is a you know, the commercial property lawyers, and that's not said very lightly. So to be able to go through a document like this and what it all means is pretty valuable. Please don't rush out there and go and use standard documents, no matter who prepared them. You know, even having this, there's no way I would use this without having it rewritten for a particular circumstance. The circumstances change so dramatically. Now, I've just left the page there on the grantee's lawyer. You can see there, Munro Thompson, that's how you spell it. That's Calvin's and Terry's address there. And the phone number. And if we just want to go through and Calvin, you might say your website, your email again.
All right. It's Calvin, that's Calvin, at Munro Thompson, all one word, .com.au. That's actually our fax number. Our phone number is 5444 3466. But if you're all on the web now, you know, if you can just jot down that email address, that would probably be the easiest way to make contact with us. And certainly, you know, if not me, someone will answer that email for you. And certainly feel free, and I mean this sincerely, feel free to give me a call if you've got any queries about anything that we've raised tonight. You know, it feels a bit rushed, I think, with some of these things, and for, because there's, you know, however many of you are out there, some stuff you might have wanted a bit more and some a little less, so, you know, it's hard to deal with it on a one-on-one stuff. So, again, please, you know, if you've got some more questions you need answered, send me an email. I'll make sure I'll answer that, and that's a promise to you.
That's great, Callum. I'll just ask you one question because I think it's probably worth mentioning, is how does someone lodge a caveat on a property and how do you remove one?
Lodging a caveat is not that easy. You can only lodge a caveat if you have what is called a caveatable interest. And a caveatable interest generally is an interest in land. You know, we do sometimes get people ringing up and say, oh, I'm owed X amount of dollars, I'm a trader, I want to lodge a caveat on this guy's property. Well, you can't if that's all you have, because that is not an interest in land. Now, if you're clever about it, even as a trader, you could arrange that if your trading terms have certain clauses in there, that may create an interest in land. But without that sort of stuff, you generally just can't lodge a caveat on people's property. So you either have to have some level of interest in that particular property to lodge a caveat. Now, signing a contract to purchase a property is a caveatable interest. All right? Now, to lodge a caveat, there are forms to fill out, and they are title office forms. Again, these forms are not that easy to fill, because one part of it you have to say, what is your caveatable interest? So that sort of description can't be just, you know, I sign a contract X, Y, and Z. There are, you know, special terms to use. Again, you know, you do need to see a lawyer about, you know, lodging caveats on property, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, Calvin, well, we have gone massively over time, so thank you so, so much for being on the call. I mean, it's a lot of information there, huge amount of interest in options at the moment. I will be covering a little bit more on that on the next call regarding the process and the uplift and the options fee and all that sort of thing. If you do have any questions, please send them through, and I'll make sure that I've got any of the legal issues cleared off with Calvin, or he might even pop on for a couple of minutes and answer anything that we need to, if we need to, in the next call. Otherwise, email him. You know, talk to him. Get on the email and email Calvin. He's very approachable. He's not one of these lawyers that you know, you'd be scared of. Calvin's fabulous. He's got two little beautiful children and a lovely wife, and he's very normal. We think these solicitors are unapproachable, but they're not at all. So Calvin certainly demystifies the legal profession. So it's great to have a wonderful resource like Calvin on board with this whole process, because it is something that, you know, you've got contracts, you're signing something, you're putting your name to it. What you're doing is you're committing to what it says. So you've got to understand 100%. What it actually says. So thank you again, Calvin, for being on the call. Thank you, everybody, for joining in tonight. As I said, it's been a pretty long one tonight. So thank you again. It will be recorded, and it will be up on the website for you all to listen to again if you want to, any part of it, or for those of you who haven't listened to it yet, obviously it's there for you to download. So thank you, guys. Talk to you again in a fortnight. Get your questions in, because I'll be answering those questions and anything more on options and how they work and the mechanics of them. Get them through to me and we'll deal with them on the next one. So thanks heaps, Calvin. Any parting words?
Thank you. Sorry?
Any parting words?
No, I thought 8 o'clock for talking about options was going to send everyone
We're
to sleep.
We're now a quarter to ten.
I know. I thought I was going to get my cup of hot Horlicks or Milo.
I'll leave you to it now. Thanks, Calvin.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.